This is Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact, a co-production of Bloomberg and Federal News Radio.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions meet business decisions, online at www.bgov.com, and of course on the air at Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, Thursdays at 11 and Fridays at 2:30.
We gather here in memory of 20 beautiful children and 6 remarkable adults. They lost their lives in a school that could have been any school, in a quiet town full of good and decent people that could be any town in America.
This week, we're tackling the tragedy that happened in Newtown, Connecticut from a couple of different angles. Number one, the president has said he plans on doing something about guns, but how simple will that be? The Second Amendment isn't something he can just rewrite. And what about gun lobbyists? How upset will they be? Bloomberg Television's White House correspondent Juliana Goldman will be here to discuss. But my first guest is Kirsten Todd Kuhn, the president and CEO of Liberty Group Ventures, a company that specializes in risk management strategies, both the design and implementation. She deals with Fortune 500 companies every day to discuss topics just like this. Kirsten, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Alan. Always great to be here with you.
Thank you. This is kind of right up your alley.
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately, it is. But you're on the planning end of it to hopefully prevent it from happening. As we take a look at what happened in Connecticut, is there a way to plan for a scenario like this?
Well, I think there are a few components to what happened. I mean, the first is schools and businesses, any sort of public institution like that, run training and exercises. By all accounts, this school had done a tremendous job of training their teachers and exercising the teachers and the students into different types of scenarios that were obviously not fear-based, but just to help the kids. So the teachers were able to use trigger words that were not fearful, right, but that were able to collect the students into a place of safety. There's that extraordinary story of courage by one of the teachers who had taken her kids to what she told them was a safe place and then got them into a closet, and then the shooter came in and asked her where they were, and she said they were in a gym. But to mobilize kids of that age in such a deliberate and thoughtful and organized way in such a state of chaos, when chaos is just reeling outside, happens because teachers are educated about what they should do, and they make the right decisions based on training and education for themselves.
The principal had recently instituted the doors locked at 9:30 phenomenon or mm-hmm. scenario, so to speak. I know my daughter's school does the same thing, and it's a controlled entry. Unfortunately, this gentleman, and I use the term loosely, gentleman, shot his way through the door. Do you envision people turning to ballistic companies now to fortify front doors and entryways?
No, that's not the answer. I mean, if you have somebody coming to your door with a gun at 9:30, they're going to get in. Right. So you've got a couple issues going on here. The first is you want to create deterrence, and you want to make sure that when that happens, that you minimize the damage. And by all accounts, looking at what the teachers did and how they're educated, I think that they certainly minimized what was already a tragic and horrific circumstance based on their training and education. This becomes an issue of guns and mental health. And that is something that is really critical to what's happened here. When we talk about preventing these types of incidents, it's not about school security. School security manages the day-to-day, and it manages what happens when somebody comes in. But this instance of what happened in Newtown, Connecticut, is much more, in my opinion, about the gun issues and mental health illness and how we are not getting enough services for individuals who have mental health needs and their families.
It appears as though in this particular instance, the gentleman had been receiving mental health treatment, unfortunately, and it was also the case in, I believe, Aurora, Colorado. The people were not, they were receiving treatment, but they weren't abiding by what was being told. So they went astray of what their doctor had actually recommended.
Well, one element that we don't always remember about Virginia Tech is the shooter had actually been in court, and the judge had not ruled for mandatory, involuntary inpatient treatment. He had ruled for outpatient treatment. Right. And what happens in those situations is that we don't have the resources to then monitor what they're doing with that outpatient treatment. And so it is not just enough to get the services, but we need to have closer monitoring of what happens in those cases. 50%, and I believe this is a pretty conservative number, 50% of inmates in our federal jails have mental illness. So we are dealing with an issue that goes far beyond how we're treating it. And we need to go a lot lot deeper into the services that we're providing.
Big retailers are now beginning to pull assault-style weapons off the shelves, Walmart being the first one to make a move. Do you envision this becoming a problem or a boon, so to speak? And what I mean by that is, yeah, the assault-style rifles are coming off the shelves, but the law still hasn't changed. People can still go out and get these weapons as they see fit. Do you see more people going out to purchase these guns now or maybe holding back? I know the politicians, Senator Joe Manchin, for example, card-carrying member of the NRA, is like, you know, I love to hunt, but something needs to be done.
Well, I think pulling guns off the shelf is a strong sign of it's demonstrative, but it's not enough. I mean, it's more of a symbol than actually right. than what needs to be done. I think looking at where the laws are, if there were ever a time for a call to action on how we look at gun laws and how we look at guns in this country, this is it. And I was speaking with one of the survivors from Virginia Tech who was saying that, you know, this is we often talk about remorse and regret. And Captain Mark Kelly, Gabby Gifford's husband, says the same thing. It's enough. We have to stop saying we're sorry. And, you know, just saying, isn't this horrible? And then moving on to the next step. We need to take action based on what's happened. And if there were ever a time to do that, to have a call to action on the gun issue and mental health illness, because I believe the two are linked in a very strong way.
Yeah.
Guns don't shoot themselves. It is now.
I'm still baffled at what the mom was thinking about taking her son to a gun range.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know enough about his mental illness, what the situation was. She clearly had an interest in guns. I think, you know, a lot of times in these situations, we look at the symptoms of what's happened, and it's really about getting to the cause.
And
how to minimize the damage.
All right, so moving forward, now we've got this horrible tragedy behind us. They're still dealing with the aftermath in Connecticut. What are the next steps? What would you, if you were consulting this organization, the city of Newton, Connecticut, what would you recommend?
Well, I think Newtown has already decided to close down the school, and I think they're going to be taking the kids to another school. And it's really about emotional healing, because on a security front, as I said, everything that we've learned about how the teachers responded, what the principal did, they were really on top of their school security. And in fact, in ways that a lot of schools aren't, they were running evacuation drills. They were running shelter in place drills, which a lot of schools don't do. And they were using words for their kids that were not fear-based, because this is not about living in a state of fear. It's about living in a state of awareness and protection. And we're not going to prevent everything, but what we need to manage is how we respond when something happens. Right. And that's a lot harder with kids because they're unpredictable. And this school had trained their teachers to talk through with kids how to handle a situation when it's going on. And so I think one of the big takeaways for schools is fire drills are not enough.
Right.
You need to really be working with evacuation and shelter in place, and what that means for kids. It doesn't have to be because there's a shooter. There are lots of scenarios that are innocuous for all intents and purposes that can train kids to respond in a situation like that. And again, it's not to create the sense of fear in schools, but it's about creating resilient children. And these issues and these events are happening. For whatever reason, we're seeing more natural disasters, more man-made disasters. And to go with a perspective of prevention, it winds us too tightly. It's like the Titanic. If you're so sure nothing's going to happen, then when something happens, you're unbelievably prepared that you're ill-prepared, that you become devastated. And so I think the principle for risk management right now is really about resilience and figuring out how to respond and recover most effectively.
The president has clearly said he wants to do something about this constitutionally. I don't know if the president has any wiggle room. We'll be talking to Juliana Goldman from Bloomberg Television in just a little while about that. There's also the issue of money. Gun lobbyists, lots of money out there being spent to back campaigns for people. What's going to happen to that money? That's another question.
Ed Rendell had a piece over the weekend where he calls the NRA a paper tiger. He said he won three times without NRA support. I don't know enough about campaigning and all of that. I think the issue being that we can't be fearful of it, that we can't walk away. I'll tell you, I was dismayed to hear some of the politicians this weekend who are from that area, from the district, when asked, what are you going to do, to really hedge, to say, well, you know, we'll look at priorities, we'll look at lessons learned. We can't afford to hedge anymore. Somebody's got to step out there and not make this a dialogue of polar opposites, but find where the middle ground is. Because if you talk to the Brady campaign, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit on issues that people agree on. Criminal background checks for gun purchase. 40% of guns are bought today without background checks.
It's easier to get a driver's license in some states. easier to get a gun than it is to get a driver's license in some states.
Exactly. I mean, there are very easy things that we can just start to do in these first steps. No one's saying that people shouldn't have guns, but what we're talking about is a management and a regulation of guns that reflects the danger that they can wreak on an environment, on a situation.
Interesting news. We'll talk about the NRA and Facebook and Twitter and how the three of them intertwine in just a little while. Final thoughts.
If we look at what Sandy Hook Elementary School did in preparation for this, they had done everything they could have done. They had trained their teachers, they had trained their students, their administrators. They were well aware of what it meant to be a secure and safe school. They really employed the concepts of resilience in a way that minimized the destruction and the death that they had at that school, which is hard when you're talking already about 20 deaths. The key is that every school, every business, we have to really understand what it means to be resilient and how we can prepare ourselves for any type of disaster. And that's training, exercise, and really thinking through what it is to be in a state of awareness and preparation.
Keep your head on swivel. That's what I got to say. That's what I tell my daughter. You know what? You're in school. You're around a bunch of people that you may or may not know, but keep your wits about you.
I think the idea of why schools, it's so hard because it's such a violation of innocence. I mean, it's a sanctuary.
Exactly.
And it's a tremendous violation of innocence that we're feeling. But obviously, our hearts and prayers go out to all of those families and to that community.
What do you tell children?
It is really hard. I have a first grader and a third grader, and they were asking a lot of questions. And this incident takes the innocence away from a lot of kids, because you need to be forthright with them. You need to be honest with kids, but managing what you tell them. And, you know, you talk about what happens when somebody's sick and what they can do. And it's about, you know, trusting the teachers. And I mean, and you hear the weaknesses in everything that you say, because any one of those weaknesses could be challenged. But I think you do have to share with your children what it is, because that helps them be more prepared for themselves, but
sure,
within reason, because you can't tell them everything.
My daughter said to me just a couple of days ago, I asked her how things were going at school, and she said things were great. There were no police cars out front today.
We try to protect that innocence for so long, and you can't in an environment like this. And you don't want your kids not to know, because that hurts them.
Her name is Kirsten Todd-Kuhn. She is the president and CEO of Liberty Group Ventures. Give us a website where people can find out more.
Sure, it's www.libertygroupventures.com.
Kirsten, as always, it's a pleasure having you here.
Thanks so much, Alan. Always great to be with you.
Carrying guns on a college campus, for example, is one of the dumbest things I've ever heard of in my life. I don't remember what you were like when you were in college, but I shouldn't have had a gun when I was in college, nor should anybody I knew. We just don't need guns every place. We don't need people carrying guns in public places. That's not what the Founding Fathers had in mind. It doesn't add to anybody's safety. Quite the contrary.
That's the mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg. And in the interest of transparency, he's the majority owner of Bloomberg LP, of which this show is a subsidiary.
In the coming weeks, I'll use whatever power this office holds to engage my fellow citizens, from law enforcement to mental health professionals, to parents and educators, in an effort aimed at preventing more tragedies like this.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Joining me now is Bloomberg Television's White House correspondent, Juliana Goldman.
It's great to be.
The president clearly stated he wants to get the ball rolling on a solution to this whole gun thing. However, it may not be as simple as just saying, make it so.
Right. There is a long history of the NRA pushing back against such efforts to tackle gun control. One of the interesting things you're seeing now is, though, that the NRA has been largely silent in the wake of Friday.
I was just about to say, Facebook, gone.
Facebook, nothing on Twitter. Spokespeople haven't been responding to comment. And so that's one of the things that is making you think that now this could be a tipping point. Now it's different.
Right. Right. Things are definitely different. You've got a lot of senators in the back seat, so to speak, with regard to the NRA. Senator Joe Manchin being one of the most vocal from West Virginia. I'm a card-carrying member straight from West Virginia. I love to hunt. But you know what? And he's one of the most bipartisan ones at the same time. So when he starts to speak, people might actually listen.
You've got Manchin. You've also got Senator Warner now from Virginia, who has an A rating from the NRA and saying, no, we really need to take action. Even John Yarmuth of Kentucky, who said, I've been silent, but now I feel sorry that I've been silent, that something needs to be done. And so when you have that, when you have pro-gun Democrats starting to step up, Republicans you know, not really speaking up either. And then Democrats like Dianne Feinstein saying that she wants to reintroduce and push for the assault weapons ban. Senator Leahy saying that he's going to hold hearings. You know, there is a short window of time, though,
sure,
to do this. And so the president is going through various options. One of the considerations for the White House is, you know, whether or not they pursue actions by executive order, which wouldn't be as strong as things you could pursue legislatively, and then that might actually weaken the impetus for legislative action.
We're talking about, you know, the Second Amendment. It's not like you can rewrite it at this point.
So
it's going to take a little bit of work, not to mention, as I kind of mentioned a little while ago, there are a lot of lobbyists behind guns. How much money are we talking about?
We're talking about a lot of money, but, you know, it does raise questions about the power of the NRA, and you have folks like Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York saying that the fear is really just out of fear itself, that the money isn't as powerful now as it once was back in, you know, 1994 and whatnot. But you just look at the 2012 election cycle, the Center for Responsive Politics, they crunched some numbers, and through mid-October, gun rights groups contributed a total of $3 million to candidates. 96% of that was for Republicans. And by contrast, gun control groups spent less than in any cycle, $4,000 went to candidates. Yeah, it's just a stark. And the National Rifle Association, of course, spending the most, about $1 million to back candidates. But then on top of that, for their independent expenditures, so putting money into advertising, other forms of political activity, they spent about $17 million, most of which, of course, went to Republican candidates. But then here's another interesting statistic. So we're talking of that, only about $1 million went to candidates that actually won. And so there's about, you know, less than 5% return on the NRA's investment, which then leads one to say, okay, so really the politicians are operating out of fear here, and the lobby is not as powerful as it once was.
Well, that would kind of lend itself to that. Or they're developing a pretty big farm team of people who they could potentially move to the forefront.
Well, and they have a track record of success here.
Right.
You know, on Bloomberg Television this morning, we were talking about just in Connecticut, how last year there was a proposal that would limit High Magazine, that would make owning even a High Magazine a felony, and it would actually remove such weapons out of the state. And just the NRA, gun makers, launched a campaign to oppose that, and, you know, and they won. So there's a long track record here, and, you know, it's unclear. Since we haven't heard from the NRA, since they have been silent, we don't know what they're preparing.
Would that be a High Magazine count for an assault weapon, or just a handgun, or just High Magazine in general?
Just High Magazine. It would have made it a felony to possess magazines with more than with 10 bullets. It would have forced owners to surrender them to law enforcement to get them out of the state. And of course, now we know that the weapon that was used in Connecticut was a Bushmaster AR-15 rifle with High Magazines containing 30 rounds.
30 rounds in that magazine alone. I mean, you look at companies like, a lot of the assault weapons now are being pulled from shelves. You look at Walmart, and they're starting to pull those AR-15s off the shelves, or things similar to it that can be considered assault weapons.
Yeah, but, you know, it was interesting. One of the other things we were talking about today is that even when the assault weapons ban was in place, gun makers still figured out ways to get around it. So making like minor cosmetic changes to these guns and changing their names. So for example, the Tech DC9, that's a 9mm semi-automatic handgun. Intratec, the manufacturer, made a minor change. They limited it to a 10-round magazine, but it could still be fitted with the high-capacity magazines. And then they changed the name to the AB10, AB for after ban.
Okay, that's not funny.
And no, but it shows the history. It shows what politicians are up against.
That's like a slap in the face, is what that is.
Yeah.
That's I'll fix you. No worries. We'll change the name and still make it happen. Stock prices are starting to fall for some of these major ones. Looking at Smith & Wesson, for example, $8 in some cases, I believe it was.
And you see
recently
Cerberus private equity pulling its stake out of gun manufacturers as well.
You look at their websites, and their websites are far more I wouldn't say that they are shopping for the everyman or every woman. It's more like a military site. You're looking at, I mean, specifically looking at Smith and Wesson, the one that I looked at most recently. They've got the M&P series, the military and police series, which you would think is specifically for military or police people. But no, those are sold to civilians. Anybody can purchase those. And just looking at the M&P 22, specifically, 10-round magazine with one in the chamber. Mm-hmm. There's 11 right there. How are they going to go around and police the number of shells that are actually in the gun itself?
Yeah, I mean, these are all questions in the wake of this horrific tragedy. But you know, there's also an argument that they've been successful at making, which is jobs and the economy.
This is very true.
In Connecticut, one of the arguments to push back against that legislation was that Connecticut's home to a $1.3 billion firearms industry, gun makers. Colt are based there, Ruger and also Mossberg. Supports 5,400 jobs in the state, pays $80 million in state taxes.
This is very true. Congressional order or presidential order or whatever it could, whatever he would like to do, President Obama, could be detrimental to the economy, to the stock market itself as a whole. I mean, just looking here in Virginia alone, you've got Beretta based down in Southern Virginia, an organization that, makes a fine handgun. I don't own any handguns myself, but I can appreciate them. Mm-hmm. But I can also appreciate the issues that are at hand right now. Juliana, thank you so much for being a part of the program.
Yeah, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Will you come back when there's more to talk about?
I would love to.
Anytime. Juliana Margulies. Where did that come from?
We spell our names the same way. It's a unique spelling. So I'm happy to be in that company.
I'm sure she'd allow you to access to her checking account as well.
Wouldn't mind that either.
Juliana Goldman, White House correspondent from Bloomberg Television. Thanks again for being here.
Sure.
I want to thank Kirsten Todd Kuhn, president and CEO of Liberty Group Ventures, for being a part of today's program. You know, Bloomberg Government has a television show? That's right. It's called Capital Gains, and it airs Sundays at 11:30 on WUSA TV9. That's immediately following Face the Nation, and it's hosted by Bloomberg's own Peter Cook. Make sure to follow us on Twitter, @BGov. For show updates, be sure to follow me, @AlanLScott. We'll get together again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Why? Because we got plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions.
Joining me here today are people from across the nation who have either survived gun violence, including recent mass shootings, or have lost family members to gun violence. And if you think there's a lot of people here, that is because there's an awful lot of gun violence in our country. Since last Friday's tragedy in Connecticut, dozens of grieving parents and grandparents and an entire deeply wounded community now know the kind of anguish that these people with me have endured. What happened in Newtown was an unspeakable crime, a mass murder in which 6- and 7-year-old children were gunned down in their classrooms, along with their elementary school teachers and administrators. And to all of those who lost loved ones, our hearts are broken and our prayers certainly are with you. Last night, the president said he would use whatever powers his office holds to address this violence, and I think it is critical that he do so.
That's the mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg. And in the interest of transparency, he's the majority owner of Bloomberg LP, of which this show is a subsidiary. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.
Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. Copyright 2012 Bloomberg LP.